C.S. Lewis described happiness like this. A car is made to run on petrol, and it would not run properly on anything else. Now, God designed the human machine to run on himself. He himself is the fuel our spirits were designed to burn, on the food our spirits were designed to feed on. There is no other. That is why it is just no good asking God to make us happy in our own way without bothering about religion. God cannot give us a happiness and peace apart from himself, because it is not there. There is no such thing. In the world that we live in today, the most difficult question to answer is the question of evil. Where does evil come from? Why does evil exist? Why is there so much harm and pain in the world inflicted by one person over another, or one group of people over another? Why do some people continue to exploit others for their profit? Why do people take advantage of others? And we see this all the way from the toddler stage all the way through the end of life. And we see it in every culture, every part of the globe. And this is a question that academia tries to answer. It's a question that we see pundits debate. Where does it come from? But the question's been answered thousands of years ago. There's no reason to even search for the answer. The answer is clearly in the Bible. The Bible tells us where evil comes from. It's called sin. Sin is the origin of evil, and the Bible has a very clear explanation for this very troubling question. The Bible asserts very clearly that humanity, all men, all women, all teenagers, all boys and girls have a sinful nature, and that we are all very prone to sin. I love the hymn that we sing every once in a while, not often enough, but the hymn that says, "O fount of blessing." And in one of the verses, it says, "Prone to wander from the God I love." That is a fit description of human nature. So prone toward sin, so prone to wander away from good, even prone to wander away from God. In the passage we're going to read out of Luke, but I have jumped way ahead in the book of Luke today. We are actually in Luke chapter 8, and because it's Thanksgiving, I wanted to bring a message of thanks. We're jumping ahead to chapter 17, where there is a message about Thanksgiving. And the passage actually begins talking to us about the sin problem, or rather the root of the sin problem. In this passage, Jesus talks about our terrible sinful nature. But he also states very clearly, which is stated all through the Bible, that we are going to be held accountable for our actions, something that is not taught everywhere and not believed everywhere, but the Bible is very clear about accountability. The Bible also relentlessly condemns sin. So let's read the passage. I'm going to read it section by section. Today we're going to study all the way through verse 19, but I'm only going to begin reading verses 1 through 4 of Luke 17. Jesus said to his disciples, "The things that cause people to sin," there is our word, "to cause people to sin are bound to come. But woe to that person through whom they come. It would be better for him to be thrown into the sea with a millstone tied around his neck than for him to cause one of these little ones to sin. So watch yourselves. If your brother sins, rebuke him, and if he repents, forgive him. If he sins against you 7 times in a day and 7 times comes back to you and says, 'I repent,' forgive him." Now, Jesus says that there are things that cause people to sin, and that we should expect to see sin in this world that we're living in, but we're also warned to not be sinners and to not cause any other person to sin. He actually says that we should watch ourselves and make sure that we don't sin. He tells us to make sure we don't cause someone else to sin. He tells us if we see someone who is sinning and we know they are, we should confront them about their sin. If that person should ask us to forgive them, we should forgive them, and we should continually forgive them. Now, that's a high standard much higher than any of us would be able to keep on our own, because it's God's standard, and you can't do this without God's help. But with God's help, you can. Not only can, you can, but God expects us to live this way. Let me illustrate what it's like to live in this world a righteous life with the help of God. During World War II, many Allied prisoners suffered tremendously in prisoner of war camps, especially under the Japanese, because these were brutal places to live. Dr. Richard Dawson learned something very important while serving in the British Army during World War II. Dawson spent time in one of these brutal Japanese prison camps. As a doctor, it was his job to attend the prisoners. So daily he watched soldiers dying of treatable diseases that here in America they would have been treated. But there in the Japanese camps, they died. Most of these illnesses and affections came from drinking contaminated water in the rivers and swamps surrounding the prison. It may have started with a little stomach virus or some dehydration or some diarrhea, but it was fatal. One day, Dawson, looking for some kind of solution, began to wonder if there wasn't something around him that could help him with his soldiers. And as he looked up, he saw coconut trees everywhere and coconuts. And he remembered someone telling him that the milk of an unripe coconut tree was very sterile. So he harvested coconuts, unripe coconuts, and he set them up as IVs. And he hooked up intravenously so that the water from these coconuts went into his prisoners. And there was a miraculous improvement, and prisoners who were dying right and left became healthy and strong. Incredible analogy here of what Jesus does for us. He takes the foul, debilitating part of our lives and turns it into something pure and wonderful. He gives us a love and an acceptance that we've never known. If you imagine the coconut tree, it's pulling all this contaminated water from those swamps and rivers, bringing it up, and in the process of filling up those coconuts, it transforms this contaminated water into pure water. That's what Jesus does for us. He allows us to live, but he allows us to live without sin, without overwhelming sin, and actually without causing others to sin. But how could anyone do this? Not on our own. Only with faith in God. And that's the next section. The apostles said to the Lord, after hearing what Jesus just said to them, don't sin, don't cause anybody else to sin. We need help. So they said, Lord, increase our faith. Notice the exclamation mark. He replied, if you have faith as small as a mustard seed, you can say to this mulberry tree, be uprooted and planted in the sea, and it will obey you. Jesus actually comments on faith, that faith can accomplish great things. And the disciples focus on the fact that they need more faith. But Jesus is really very clear here. It's not a question of needing more faith, but needing true faith or genuine faith. So do we need faith, more faith in ourselves? Do we need more faith in other people? Do we need faith in faith? No, what we need is faith in God. The next section is one of these sections that has a story. Jesus tells a story, and it's so teachable. It teaches us something that we all need to learn that actually can change our lives if we learn the lesson of this story. Because Jesus liked to teach things by using stories. So remember what we're talking about here. The disciples need faith so they can learn how to live in an unrighteous world and not be overcome by sin. So we're talking about faith, and Jesus tells this story to help them acquire more faith, the right kind of faith. If you don't have that connection, you won't see the connection between the story and what we're already talking about. Suppose one of you had a servant plowing or looking after the sheep. Would he say to the servant when he comes in from the field, "Come along now and sit down to eat"? Would he not rather say, "Prepare my supper, get yourself ready, and wait on me while I eat and drink. After that, you may eat and drink"? Would he thank the servant because he did what he was told to do? So you also, when you have done everything you were told to do, should say, "We are unworthy servants. We have only done our duty." So this is Jesus' story. Let's just go over it. Make sure we're all clear. So the master of the house has servants everywhere. Servants that are out in the field, servants that are taking care of the animals. And so he's been out working all day. He's the master of this household, and he comes in. And Jesus says, at the same time, some of his servants that have been out in the field plowing, they come in. He doesn't say to them, "Now sit down. You've been out there plowing. Let me fix your supper." It's their job to work out in the fields, and it's also their job to fix the supper for the master. So when they come in, he sits down, and they fix his supper. And when he gets through, he doesn't necessarily have to say, "Oh, this is incredible. You fixed my supper." This is their job description. It's what they're supposed to do. How many of you who work 8 to 5, go to your job, usually have your boss every day before you come home, come over there and sit down? "I can't believe you drove up here all day to work 8 hours at this place. And you have given of your time and sacrificed. It's just incredible." No, they expect you. They give you a paycheck for that. And in exchange, you give them the 8 or 9 hours of work. This is what is expected here. Jesus is trying to teach us an example. We have a real problem as human beings. There's a part of our psyche that lives off of affirmation. We really like for people to affirm us, to pay us compliments. When Ryan was just a little guy, about 3 years old, his older brother and sister were really kind of bugging him, or at least he thought they were. Of course, you've never seen that happen between siblings, right? And he got so aggravated at them, he said, "Listen, I don't need your compliments." He meant to say comments. But he said, "I don't need your compliments." They started laughing, of course, because we all need each other's compliments. The problem is, though, we can need each other's compliments too much. Because we can live in such a way as to want to impress other people. And then we can actually take that to God and want to live in such a way as to impress God. That doesn't work with God. You cannot impress God. But we keep trying. Brian Chappell, who used to be the president of Covenant Seminary, gives an illustration. He says, imagine that you have had a hard day working around your house, maybe, you know, doing the leaves all day. And so you're really bushed, and you go to a restaurant, your favorite restaurant, and you sit down and you order your meal. And then when the waitress brings your meal, she sets it down for you, but she also brings a plate for herself. And you say, "What are you doing?" She says, "Well, I brought your plate. I thought you could pick up my tab, and I'll just eat here too." And you say, "Hey, I might give a tip, but I'm not sharing my table with you." Or imagine you got a realtor who found you a house, and you've just emptied out the moving van, and you got the last piece of furniture, and another van drives up, and you walk out, and it's the realtor, and he's got all his furniture, and he says, you say, "What are you doing?" He says, "Well, I thought I'd take the basement. I mean, after all, I found you the house." We are really good at trying to make good impressions. I mean, just imagine somebody who is really proud of a certain brand of car. They will read everything about that car that says it is the best car, and they'll ignore everything bad about that car so that they think they have the best car around. Or have you ever noticed how companies sell us products by overtelling how good it is. I mean, hair products should actually be able to make your hair stand up and do calisthenics if we believed everything they said about them. Or the one I like is when you buy something for your kids, or even buy a grill, a barbecue grill. I had one time that actually, and I've seen this many times, it actually says, assemble in minutes, no tools required. You flip out this page, it's like 10 feet long, 65 steps, and no tools required. You're still on step 65, and you say, easy assembly. Yeah, that is trying to make a good impression. Or when's the last time you've been to the doctor, and the doctor says, you're not going to feel just a prick. Yeah, just a prick. It's absolutely incredible what we will do to impress others, to what lengths we will go and strive for their approval. Even if some people are actually impressed with us, we should really try to remember for sure that God is never, never impressed with our work or our deeds. I'm reading a huge series on the Civil War. And the general for the Union, his name was George B. McClellan. And he lost the battles to the South for an incredible reason. We know from two sources. We know from history, because during the war, they didn't know exactly the amount of soldiers on each side and the resources on each side. But after the war was over and it was all tallied up, history tells us. But we also know not a lot from this guy, because he wrote a series of letters to his wife almost every day, unveiling his heart, telling his heart. And he won major battle in Maryland, where each side lost thousands and thousands of soldiers. The South was out of soldiers. It was over. If the Union sends one more brigade across, they've been fighting for 3 days, if the Union sends one more brigade, it's over. The war will be finished. But General McClellan does not send any more soldiers over. Instead, he retreats, which he has done on many other occasions. In letters to his wife, he tells us why he retreats and doesn't send over. Because he believes the enemy has another 100,000 soldiers. They didn't have one. They'd used every soldier they had. He had 3-1. But he believed they had more than him. But the biggest reason that he would not send another brigade and keep fighting is because he believed if he lost, his reputation would be ruined for life. And he would not be able to live as a defeated man. The war would have been over 2 years earlier. But he was worried about his impression. What would people think of him if he actually lost one of the greatest battles fought? As it is, people don't think too much of him. His opponent, on the other hand, a man by the name of General Lee, only had one thing on his mind: winning. We don't want to believe that God is not impressed with our deeds. That's really hard for us. We would like to think that if I am good, God will be good to me. It just kind of makes sense to us, but not to God. If I have been faithful to church, if I've been faithful to my family, God will take note of what I've done. We would like to use our goodness as bargaining chips with God. But God doesn't take our currency. He doesn't need it. We love to make comparisons. I'm better than him. I did a better job than her. Mine is better than that. It doesn't mean a hill of beans to God. What God has moved, what he wants from us, is to acknowledge our need, our desperate need. Look at the text, Luke 17:11. Now on his way to Jerusalem, Jesus traveled along the border between Samaria and Galilee. As he was going into a village, 10 men who had leprosy met him. They stood at a distance and called out in a loud voice, "Jesus, Master, have pity on us." When he saw them, he said, "Go show yourselves to the priest." As they went, they were cleansed. Now, we've talked about lepers. This was a horrible disease, considered to have been the most horrible disease at that time. Not nearly so bad today because we know so much more about it. But people wound up with faces without noses and ears and stubbed hands and feet without toes. And they were isolated from their families, isolated from all the people. You had to live outside the city as a way of protecting the rest of the people. So they were literally cut off. And when you went about your way, you had to yell out, "Leper," so that anyone coming would have a chance to get way away from you. It was a terrible existence. And these 10 lepers, they yell out at Jesus. Now, Jesus has touched a leper once, an unfathomable thing, and healed the man instantly. And they ask Jesus if he would heal them. And Jesus does not heal them instantly. Did you know when Jesus healed some people, he didn't always heal instantly? To the man, he put he made little mud pies out of spit. Put them on his eyes, and the guy's got these little mud packs on there, and he says, "Now go wash that off." Just as blind as a bat, but when he washed his eyes off, he could see. So these guys are lepers, and he says, "I want you to go to the priests," which was prescribed by the law, "show yourselves," and they leave lepers, but on the way, they're healed. God wants us to come and acknowledge our need like these lepers did. What was the reaction of Jesus? He had pity on them. He was moved. God is not moved or impressed by our deeds, but he's moved when we acknowledge that we have need, that we fall short, that we fail. God doesn't want us to trophy our goodness. He wants to come. He wants us to come in our desperation, repent, and say, "God, help me." And God is moved when we do that. Several years ago, I was away on a trip. We lived in Puerto Rico at the time, and I get a call from Eric, and he says, "We have a problem. The keys are locked in the car." But he said, "Don't you have another set underneath the car?" And I said, "I do." He said, "Well, I can't find them." So I have him get on his back on the right side, on the right particular side of the car, and I tell him where to put his hands, and he finds the keys. That's the way it is with God. You get on your back in your desperation, and you ask God, and you let him direct you. But we all need to be reminded that God wants to hear our plea. "Jesus, have pity on me. I know there's nothing in me that should make you want to love me. I have nothing to offer you but a desperate need. Please, Lord, have pity on me." And the Lord had pity on those lepers, and he'll have pity on everyone who calls on him. He cleansed all of them. You see, the Lord loves it when we come back to say thanks. Now we're getting to the best part of the story, the Thanksgiving part. This is the part I really, really like. Begins at verse 14. When he, Jesus, saw them, he said, "Go show yourselves to the priest." And as they went, they were cleansed. That's a really important part. As they went, they were cleansed. One of them, when he saw he was healed, came back praising God in a loud voice. He threw himself at Jesus' feet and thanked him, and he was a Samaritan. And Jesus asked, "Were not all 10 cleansed? Where are the other 9? Was no one found to return to give praise to God except this foreigner?" Then he said to him, "Rise, go, your faith has made you well." So the text says, as they went, they were healed. Now, they didn't have any mirrors to know they were healed, but each other became the mirror for the other one. I mean, this guy didn't have any ears, suddenly grew ears, and another one whose nose and fingers grew out, and they're "Well, look at you. Well, what do I look like?" And I can imagine there's a celebration in the middle of this road on the way to the temple. Barnacled skin became soft and supple as toes and fingers returned and faces began to look normal and eyebrows reappeared and ears, and it was a mass miracle. But one of them stopped in his tracks. The other 9 continued on because they were doing what they were supposed to do. It's kind of like going to the priest, and the priest would say to them, "We can't find any more cancer." That's what they would hear when he say, "You don't have leprosy anymore." But the one couldn't go another step. He was just seized with the emotion of gratitude. This moment just overtook him. He's had leprosy his whole life, and it's gone. And he can't. He's going to go, but he can't go forward anymore. He's got to go back. The other nine are Jews, and he's a Samaritan. He may have had a little doubt as to when he goes back, if Jesus finds out he's a Samaritan, he may want to take the healing back. But he had to do it. The gratitude was just so great that he goes back. Now I'd like you to look at the three questions that Jesus asked in verses 17 and 19. They're just a series of three questions. The first one is, were not all 10 healed? These are not rhetorical questions. These are real questions. We got one guy here, right? Weren't there 10? Am I missing something? So the next question is very obvious. Where are the other nine? Where are they? And then the last one, was the Samaritan the only one who came back to thank God? He was. First of all, the other nine missed this incredible opportunity. When few people have this, it's about 1 out of 10 who actually experience this. The story really demonstrates. Most people just go through life too fast. Only about 1 out of 10 is able to just be stopped in their tracks and seized with this moment of this powerful emotion. Perhaps the greatest emotion that there is gratitude. Someone says the greatest emotion is relief. But I think it's a toss-up between gratitude. He stops his journey and he goes back to Jesus. Something about people who stop their journey and go back, they're never the same. His health will mean more to him the rest of his life. His life will mean more. Whatever he has will mean so much more. I challenge you, if you've never been stopped, just overwhelmed with gratitude, just think about it, what God's done for you. I still remember when I was just 15 and God saving me. No trophies to give to God, nothing to impress God. I still remember when I was 17 and God calling me to the ministry. Now here I am with white hair and all these years, having preached thousands of sermons. In fact, this is number 2,601 to People's Church in 16 years. How many times can I remember the Lord saying, this way, son? And in everything I have, everything I own or acquire, it's all because of God. It's because of His grace and His grace. I stand here before you today. We have a little preschooler over at the daycare that also is at the church, and she told her grandmother, she said, you know the guy that preaches? She said, you mean the pastor? Yeah, the white-haired guy. He actually attends my school, too. She said, he attends? Yeah, he said he goes there every day. I could never have done anything on my own. But I will point out one thing that I have been good at. And it's made all the difference in the world. And it's acknowledging my need to God. That really works. You go to God and you say, God, I can't make this marriage work. I can't raise these kids. I can't pastor this church. God hears prayers like that.